Hi there, Greg.
Oh, hey, Kevin, I hear you loud and clear.
Excellent. Glad we could connect.
Yeah,
So,
me too.
all right, great. So let's start with your year of graduation, including if you finished coursework spring, summer, fall, and your major or majors.
Yeah, 2019. It was in May of 2019. I actually like squeezed everything into 3 years. I did contemporary writing and production, CWP, and I minored in video game music. I think they've turned it into a major now, but they didn't have the major when I did the minor. I think it was a couple years after I left, they made it a proper major.
Gotcha. Gotcha. Okay, so you were CWP. Very cool.
Yeah,
And
my entire purpose was doing video game music. Like the
right.
CWP is like that was just a means to getting into the video game music classes.
I get it. It was like I tell people that my father was a computer science major, but literally computer science wasn't a term when he went to college, so he
Exactly.
officially studied applied mathematics.
Yeah. I was in college to study interactive music implementation, right? That's what I wanted to do, but it was a
Yep.
minor, not a major.
You shoehorned your Berkeley education into your design. That's great. What was your principal instrument?
Piano.
Piano. Nice. All right. We will get to your history later, but for now, tell us about your current job. Where do you work? What do you do?
I currently work for a company called The Glimpse Group. They are a virtual reality, augmented reality company. They sort of have like, it's sort of an umbrella company with a whole bunch of kind of subsidiary companies underneath them, a whole bunch of different projects. I used to work for XR Terra, which is an online boot camp that teaches people XR development. And XR Terra got bought by The Glimpse Group. So that is basically who my parent company is now, is The Glimpse Group is who I work for. And we do like a lot of stuff related to XR. But like my role a good chunk of time was teaching courses to adults and to students. We did K-12 kind
Okay,
of
by
courses.
the
We
way,
did adult stuff.
this is great, but I'm asking you about your current job. We'll get to your history later. But is your
Well,
current job still to
that's the
teach?
current job, right?
Okay,
It's sort
cool.
of shifting a little bit towards other things, but technically I am still teaching classes, yes.
Gotcha. Gotcha. Okay, sorry to misunderstand you there.
No worries.
So you say you're teaching classes. Hey, I teach classes for a living, but can you, I think of, is this one of those quote boot camps where people are in class like 30 to 40 hours a week for a few months? And
No. It's kind of an after, not so after school or after work kind of thing. So there's a couple of different kinds of classes, right? There's the ones that are for adults, which are like 6:30, 9:30 p.m. kind of once a week, sort of thing, where I also offer outside of those 3 hours, like personal one-on-one office hour support for technical issues and troubleshooting and stuff. But I also teach like classes in schools, like middle schools and high schools, and like for that we have to kind of adapt to their the time block schedules, because every school's different. Do they have 45 minutes? Do they have 90 minutes? Kind of in one block
oh, so you're
to
like
teach.
an outside speaker coming in to, or actually, when you do that, like, is it just kind of for one day or is it for an
No,
entire
it's
day?
like so a couple of weeks often. I'm doing one, for example, this summer that's at the YMCA, for example, and that one's going
Oh,
to be
nice.
1 week where like every day for 5 days it's a 3 hour kind of block. We kind of adapt and shift like the actual scheduling a bit, but they are like proper like courses. It's not like a one day thing. Although I do those as well, right? I do like professional development days where I come in and just do a presentation. I'm doing that on Thursday, for example. I just show up and for an hour talk about XR technology for a bunch of students.
Okay, so like for the ones where it's students taking a class, but let's just start with the kids, like even this YMCA class as an example.
Sure.
And you're in Massachusetts, right?
Yes.
Cool. So like what are you teaching? Are you teaching them like the basics of coding? Are you teaching them just the sort of how to use the stuff? Like what are they gonna say, oh yeah, this guy came in and he taught me this, like, he's from the Glimpse Group and we learned. right? What
Yeah, VR
Sims
development.
Descends.
In particular, the one that we're doing this summer with the YMCA, we use a online. It's a web browser-based 3D engine. It used to be called CoSpaces. It's now called Delightex. And we developed curriculum for it because so many schools have Chromebooks, which don't do like the industry standard software, which is like Unity or Unreal. Those don't work on Chromebooks. But what does work on Chromebooks is 3D engines that work in a browser. Like you just go to a website and sign in. And one of the ones that we like the best for that is Delightex. And they create these interactive 3D experiences that can run on the Chromebook, but also can be shared in a way that you can use augmented reality on like a personal phone. And also that same world can be accessed in a virtual reality headset. Basically, you just create this share code and you plug that kind of six-letter code in the headset app. And then you can wander around the 3D environment that you created. We do code. CoSpaces, or rather Delightex, has something they call CoBlocks, which is similar to Scratch, in sort of a drag and drop sort of mode of coding. But we show them how to like add click interactions, how to store variables, how to execute functions. So a lot of like software basics we go over. And we also show them, we talk about 3D models and animations and how to move things around and how to create like dialogue trees, you know, to create like branching narratives and things like that. So we do a lot of the
Right,
sort of
so
introductory
it's not
stuff.
the most hardcore engineering, but it's getting them to the point where they can build use this software to build very interesting stuff, is what I
And try
mean.
it out too. Like they can try it in VR. It's like, that's the coolest bit. It's like we get these like middle schoolers who would otherwise basically like the alternatives are like using Unity and stuff, right? Like the industry standard software. But these middle schoolers who would otherwise maybe, you know, it might be a little too advanced for them, but they can actually create a VR application, right? Like in 2 hours. We have a workshop that we run in 2 hours that's like, all right, we have 2 hours. Everyone get on this website. We're gonna create a VR application and the kids love it.
That's great. And then what about the classes for adults? What are those like?
Those
Like
are
how?
a little bit of a longer time commitment. They're usually for people who are trying to do some kind of like a pivot in their career, or they're trying to learn something new. Maybe they're a software developer. So those are typically like so for example, the intro course I would say is we call it VR Developer Foundations. It's an 8 week sort of course. Once a week we do a 3 hour class. In the evening, and we go through using Unity, which is sort of I would say, one of the most industry standard tools for XR development. We use Unity, we teach how to use this program, we have them create virtual reality applications, we show them how to write C sharp scripts, we show them how to develop and create and implement their own animations, how to you know, create these sort of interactions, and how to, you know, detect collisions in physics collisions and triggers and things like that. So we go over a lot of the kind of foundational stuff. That's the intro course. And then we also have a more advanced course, which admittedly we haven't actually run as much recently because there's not as many people interested in that. But that advanced course ends up being more about team-based, you know, team-based development. So you learn about version control, and we also talk about multiplayer implementation. We talk about AI navigation, like how to move a character around a scene, you know, if they're not a real person, and a whole bunch of things related to like, you know, design. So like lighting and user interface implementation. So we have kind of like our intro course is like 8 weeks, foundations course, and then we have the sort of team-based, more advanced course that we do for adults, and that one is 16 weeks, and that is, you know, 3 hours a week kind of deal. And the idea be is the expectation is that you are also spending a good chunk of time outside of the class working on your own projects and asking for help, and then I'm doing office hour support for that.
Gotcha. If this is a trade streaker, by all means, skip. But if you're doing a lot of these basic, let's say, 8 week course, and this is something you get, so like, do you know how much someone pays to take that?
Yeah, well, it's, you know, usually we give like discounts and stuff. The course is actually priced at $1,499. We
Okay.
have a tendency to offer discounts to people, so it ends up being more like 1,000 or 750.
Okay.
You know,
I
but
know.
that's kind of what it is priced at. Admittedly, to some extent, that's for VR Developer Foundations, and then for the more advanced one, it's like $3,500.
Well, the other one's twice as long, so you'd expect
Yeah,
it to be
that's the
ballpark twice as
idea,
long.
right?
Yeah. I would say this, that I don't think it's much of a trade secret. I couldn't give you the exact number, but Berkeley Online, which I teach for them as well, that's a 12-week course. It's not so much in front of somebody, but whatever. But that's about 1,500. So, a couple more weeks, but it's all automated, plus, like 1 hour a week in person. So, like that feels pretty in line with what, if you'd said guess, I would have guessed, about that. Cool.
Well, and I think the thing that I pride myself the most on is live troubleshooting support. So like the thing when you're learning like a new technology in particular is there's like a ton of video tutorials that show you how it should work. And then when it doesn't work like that, you kind of get stuck just figuring out what went wrong. And for me in particular, when I was learning this, that was the biggest blocker. It's like, okay, well, this is the tutorial, but my thing doesn't work like that. So how do I fix it so that it does? And I have a good amount of experience troubleshooting like beginners projects, and so I'm actually really, really good now at troubleshooting problems for people trying to do this stuff. So I basically save people hours of like banging their head against documentation and videos and things like that. It, like having a real person there to like explain what went wrong can be super useful, basically. Like what checkbox did I accidentally click? So I do have like a like there is an emphasis on live troubleshooting support. Even the way that I structure my classes is about having people try and do this themselves, and then when something goes wrong, they ask a question, and everybody else gets to hear the solution because we get to troubleshoot things live together, which is nice. I think that especially for
That's
Unity and stuff, you learn the most from solving weird problems.
okay. Nice. I have a question for you because,
Sure.
and let me even share on my end, educator to educator. Okay. Because I am a full t member of the full-time faculty at Berkeley, but, I am actually in front of students 12 hours a week, right? And the rest, it's not like no full-time faculty is in front of students 40 hours a week, right? And it's not that really like we're doing a lot of other stuff, including like talking to you at this moment. So my question is like, so how many hours? It's a full-time job you're in, I assume, and I'm guessing you're salaried. Okay, how many? And I'm sure it varies, but on average, how many hours a week are you in front of students?
So yes, it varies. When I'm actually doing a class, it tends to be something like 10 to 15 hours a week. But a lot there has been, especially recently, a lot more non-teaching stuff that I've been doing as part of my job. Right, we're doing some pivoting. We do some like professional development for teachers. I mean, a lot of what I do ends up being like curriculum development, or creating courses, although less of that recently. One of the things that I have been actually like spending a good chunk of my time recently has been like a completely different project, which is called Mariner, specifically about trying to use the Fortell reality platform that Glimpse Group has. They've recently added an AI conversation feature to it, and we're hoping to use that to train people to be, well, one, train immigrants to speak English, and two, train people to be home healthcare aides, possibly those same immigrants we just taught to speak English. And home healthcare aides are people who take care of old or disabled people. There's kind of a significant lack of those people. So we're tr and a lot of that training is how to hold a conversation with people, or like, these difficult or like hard conversations that you might have to have with somebody about stuff. And one of the things that AI is particularly good for is talking forever, and role playing stuff. So we're one of the things I'm working on a lot recently. It has been actually spending like a majority of my time is kind of developing these sort of scenarios to train people to be home healthcare aides. Using these kind of
Interesting.
AI role play situations. So, like, yes, I do teach, but that is not like the only thing that I spend my time at. It's because, especially because I'm like salaried and full time, I'll sometimes be put onto other projects at Glimpse Group. For example, they have a nurse training simulation, and so I did some development work for that. They have a birth simulation, like simulating like women giving birth kind of thing, a multiplayer training simulation for that. So I do some quality assurance for that occasionally. So it's not just teaching anymore.
Sure. And by the way, my impression here, correct me if I'm wrong, because I will say this, in my department, right, there's, again, talking educator to educator. This never happens to me, but Berkeley has a minimum typically of 7 students for a class to run.
Sure.
And like, if someone's part-time faculty and they don't get enough enrollment, sorry, we don't have work for you this term, right? But if someone's full-time faculty and then one of their classes doesn't hit the magic 7, they then say, basically they give them a project to do. They're like, well, the class is canceled, but you get to help, do this project. You get to, devise a new filing system. You get to, redo how we do, advising, whatever it is, right? They're given some other thing to do. So I could envision a business in which, crap, there's not enough work. Well, here's a way to keep you busy. But I also can envision a model in which it's like, whoa, this guy's been around for a while. He knows his stuff. Let's give him, put him on this higher priority stuff. And in between that, or if we really are pressed for instructors, we'll send him out to teach. I get the impression you're more the latter.
That does sound about right. They do ask me to do other projects, and they like are always like, do you have the time to do this? Separate from your normal, teaching gig responsibilities. And in a lot of cases, especially recently, I've been like, yeah, I do. And so they'll have me work on another project for a little bit. To meet a deadline, for example. I've been kind of brought in a couple times for tasks like that, where it's like, okay, all hands on deck. We have an actual client and they need this thing done by X time. Could I please get, another person? And so I've kind of found myself in that role occasionally. Because I am a developer. Like that's like my job is Glimpse, but I also like work on projects on my own terms, like on my own on the side, like pretty constantly and regularly, like
Oh, wow.
separate from Glimpse. So I'm keeping myself sharp. Like I am a competent XR developer as
Oh,
well.
wow. Very cool. By the way, what's your official job title?
I think it's XR curriculum in developer and instructor.
Gotcha.
We kind of got to choose it. I mean, it's sort of a startup, or rather, when I joined XR Terra, it was sort of a startup thing. So like, official job titles weren't really a thing, but you could kind of like claim you were whatever you were, to some extent.
Yeah, all right, that works. Sure. And I know that, like, I trust me, having done so many interviews, I could end up talking to two people doing almost the identical thing, and they have wildly different titles. Okay, great. You mentioned you like the troubleshooter guy. I was going to say, in order to qualify for these interviews, you do have to enjoy what you do. So,
Yes.
in general, but like both the teaching angle and also, let's say, this, can I call it curriculum development
Sure.
angle, what is it about either or both of these that you enjoy?
Well, one, the to troubleshooting just makes me feel smart, because I get to draw upon like years of experience and be like, oh, I remember when I experienced something like that. Have you checked X? And then I can kind of talk people through problems and save them like and what I mean is literally hours of work, right? Like when I was learning this stuff the first time, I would run into a problem and it was like literally the first time I tried to make an XR application, a VR application, the first time I tried to get onto the headset took me a week and a half. Like fully week and a half just to get it working the first time. And so when I am able to take people through that process in 3 hours, I just know in my head I just saved them a week and a half personal time. So I get to feel like I'm helping, right? And I get to answer weird questions. And it does keep I kind of it does challenge my mind in a fun and interesting way. It's like, oh, you're getting this weird behavior, and I get to like solve the puzzle of how that works using what I know. So I love that troubleshooting bit. Curriculum development, it's kind of like a I've sort of I'm I've gotten really good at creating these sort of step-by-step guides that are like, what is the minimum amount of clicks you need to prove that this function works? You know, like, because especially like when you do this live class, right? You want to be as efficient as possible in showing someone how to do something. Especially like just in general, right? When you're doing tech stuff, like, you know, like every step, like, oh, you have to go and download this asset from someplace else. You want to, like, as much as possible, like, start from an empty project and demonstrate that this works, you know, from scratch, basically. And it's like, what is the least amount of clicks that you can do in order to do that? Because then I have to, not only do I have to do that live in front of people, but then they have to do it also, right? And then I have to explain to them how to do it. So every like step that you eliminate is one less thing that you have to tell them to do before they, you know, one less click that you have to explain to them how to do, basically every step that you remove. So
One
I've
less
gotten
thing
really
to
good
go
at,
wrong.
you know, because of the because like this the curriculum that I develop is something that not only I do, but my students have to do, right? I've gotten really good, one, at like being efficient about demonstrating a feature like with the least amount of clicks possible. And also I've gotten really good at creating GIFs of like every place on screen that you have to click. One of the things I found about like you know, blogs, or even sometimes videos is like, you know, they'll be like, and then you do this thing, or they'll like you know, or they'll like describe in words what you have to do, but won't show it to you per se. And for me, I've kind of like every time that happens in a video, I'm like, well, wait, go back. What did you just do? That was too fast. And so I've had like multiple notes from my students that the kind of step-by-step guides I have with a GIF of every single click that you have to do have been super useful, you know, to like to as they're kind of going through it on their own time, right? When they don't have me around, the kind of you know, step-by-step guides that I create are of high quality, and I really appreciate like you know, making those. And I reference my own work myself quite a lot, where it's like, oh, I forget how I do this, and I have the confidence to be like, oh, well, I did an exercise guide on this. Let me just go look at that. Oh yeah, that step. I almost forgot that step, and I'll go. So like, it actually serves as a useful tool for myself as well, not just for my students. And so I'm really proud of that kind of like, you know, general, like I have the work that I do is not only useful to my students but also useful to me, which is nice.
Yeah, that's great. Let's follow up a little bit because could you sort of take us? I sometimes ask people to take us through their day hour by hour, but let's do it another way instead. Let's do a kind of take us through, let's say, what a typical 3 hour class might be, right? Like, what, you know, both like kind of. And I don't just mean those 3 hours. We don't have to go into super detail if we learn this and this and this. But like, you know, is it kind of like I spend an hour reviewing and then I drive there and then I get there 30 minutes early and then, you know, then, you know, kind of from start to end from your point of view, right?
Sure.
What's it like? And then I'd also love if you could tell us a little more about your curriculum development. Again, I tend to share a lot when I'm talking to another educator. And, you know, I put together Berkeley Online's math course.
Right.
And let's say for that, I did everything just as document a Microsoft. I had to record a couple of my own videos. But besides that, I did everything as just these massive Microsoft Word documents. And then Berkeley Online had a techie who then went and turned all my Word documents into interactive web pages.
Oh, yeah.
And like, you know, so I could see curriculum development where you're just doing that. I could see, you know, there's also the person who's the techie where it's like you have to do these six things and here's exactly what I do. And then you're turning it to a web page. And then I could see the person who's a one-stop shop who's, you know, doing everything, right? On your own. So I'm kind of curious if we could just go into that level of detail there. So those were my two questions for you, and at
Sure.
your leisure.
Well, let's start with like the 3 hour class. So the nice thing, one, it's online, it's over Zoom. I've gotten really
Okay.
It was one of those things. Like I joined ExoTerra. In fact, the reason that I got hired at ExoTerra was they had just finished doing two in-person classes, and then the lockdown happened, and so they had to convert all of the in-person classes they had. They had to convert to something that could be done online, and they needed help developing all the slides and the curriculum and whatnot for that. And so they asked me for help, or rather, I had a friend, Casey, who asked me for help. So it is all online. So I've gotten really good at like screen sharing and doing Zoom annotations to show people where to click and things like that. So we basically over time we discovered when you're teaching over Zoom that one of like when you're teaching tech over Zoom, one of the most important kind of advancements and advantages of Zoom is screen sharing. Is being able to see the other person's screen and then draw on it to tell them where to click. So we kind of developed this system of teaching someone tech that's very hands-on, where it's like you are doing this, and then when something goes wrong or the behavior doesn't happen, you're already sharing your screen, and I can kind of ask you to click on different parts of the screen in order to better understand why things are going wrong and things like that. So it is a
Okay.
highly like I sort of developed this method of teaching people through giving them the instructions and they do it on their own computer. So we can see what happens when things go wrong and then fix it immediately. So for example, one class might be, well, let's go ahead and like build. I mean, like we could even start with just like like how does one build an XR application? This is usually the third class of the VR Developer Foundations. And it's like, okay, let's open up your project. First, could you please, open up the package manager? We're going to import all of these packages. And through the process of telling someone else where to click and what to do, everybody else in the class also gets that information in a detail that keeps me honest, right? Because if I leave something out, then the person who I'm instructing doesn't know what to do.
Right.
I am forced to be as explicit as possible about every single click and like every single button that people have to click on. And because I have to be so explicit about everything, it keeps me honest about like making sure I give all the necessary information in order to get this working. And because we have a class of students, I take regular breaks. Like we do like short sprints of like, let's import this package. Okay, thank you for sharing. Anybody else running into problems trying to get this package? And then somebody speaks up or pipes up, is like, I don't know what you just did. And I'm like, okay, share your screen. Let's show you, let's get you, like, keep you caught up. And it's an interesting sort of mode of teaching because it is kind of a lot of stopping and starting, where it's like, okay, let's make sure everybody's at this level. Cool. All right, let's move on to, all right, the person whose problem we just solved, right? The last person to get up to this point, you are now going to be the person who follows on to the next step. And then we do the next little step. It's like, okay, cool. Let's, figure that out and figure that out. Or like click on this, import the next package. Let's make sure that we have the XR, we've added the XR origin to our scene or whatever. And so we kind of do this sort of like incremental, like, all right, let's make sure you're up to speed. Basically, if you run into a problem on one of the previous steps, that's okay. Just share your screen and we will help you get caught up to where everybody else is through kind of me annotating on your screen and show you what you need to do. So
Sure.
it's one of those, it's kind of like it does slow things down, but one of the things that we do this because in the past I would just lecture for 3 hours. And then what would happen is all of my students would kind of watch with glazed eyes for 3 hours. And then when they tried to actually do it for themselves, they would have to re-watch the entire 3-hour video while pausing and and stopping and being like, where did you just click, and then do it themselves. And then when things went wrong, they would come to the next class being like, I got stuck on X, I got stuck on Y, I wasn't able to actually complete the things that you went over in the class. So there was like a lot of like repetition that was happening like on the students' time, and they would get stuck, and then they would not be able to get past it because it wasn't happening live.
Yeah, it's
So
not doing
basically
anyone any favors.
no, so we're like, well, you, especially when you're learning Unity, you learn the most from actually solving weird nonsense problems, which is like a con, especially in Unity. Unity's a big gray box with a bunch of hidden windows all over the place with checkboxes that can break your project if you accidentally click on them. And like, it can happen by accident, right? Like it can be clicks you didn't even know you did. And I'll be like, oh, that behavior I recognize. Could you check this component that's like two windows away from where you are right now? Oh, yeah, your checkbox is checked. You need to uncheck that. Hit play and see if that fixed it. Ta-da! Kind of like that kind of live troubleshooting gets people to the point where they have actually achieved the goals of the class. Of course, this does
Sure.
mean we had to, like, to some extent, reduce. Like it is, this is kind of hand in hand with the reduction of complexity, because everything that I have somebody do, every click, is like repeated 4 or 5 times with everybody who lags behind and isn't able to keep up, right? So that's why the efficiency of the instruction, it becomes super important. But because of that process, I've kind of refined down my classes to the least amount of clicks that you have to do in order to achieve this end result. So by the end of the class, most students will have a very simple VR scene built onto their headset. And the good news is a lot of these steps involve waiting. Well, it's good and bad news, but the good news is that, okay, great, we've hit build and run for you. While we wait the like 5 minutes it takes for this build to complete, let's check in on everybody else. And we, because of this sort of built-in lag that happens with this, we often will take the opportunity to make sure that everybody else is caught up and in the same place. It is a little messy, and it's a very, it's like constant improvisation on my part, because I'm like constantly troubleshooting, right? That my job, basically, my class is me just going through. I've done my best to create a step-by-step guide that would theoretically, if you followed everything to the exact letter, would get you to the point that we want you to be at the end of the class. But that's just not how learning tech works, right? You can get a perfectly accurate step-by-step guide, and something will go wrong. Something, maybe you miss a step, maybe you accidentally click on something, something will go wrong. As soon as you deviate from that, you need some assistance. And the good news is we've built our class around that assistance. And so it's not an interruption. It is an intended part of the course for you to run into problems and then for me to solve them live in front of the rest of the class. And then the rest of the class can see that problem. You're right. Like, oh, this behavior, if you ever see this yourself, that's because of this issue, right? And so
Sure.
it's a different kind of style. And I'm proud of it. It is very, it requires a lot of thinking on your toes. But I do believe in it. And a lot of the students kind of agree that the kind of feedback I get from my students is like, oh, wow, I learned in this, 8 week class more than I did in my entire semester trying to do the same thing in college, right? Because of this kind of like direct troubleshooting support that kind of solves a pr I think a problem that sometimes you don't get when you're just watching videos, or just going through step-by-step guides. When something goes wrong, it just grinds everything to a halt, and you need to find a real person to help you with it. And that's kind of the thing that I end up being for a lot of people. And so I love that part of it in particular.
All right, that's great. And now, how about the course development end?
Sure. Well, it ends up being so okay. The there is kind of like a varied story to like the history of our courses at Exarterra, because we started with right like an ex I came with there was an existing course that taught both VR and AR development, and then we had to shift it all to be online, and then we're like, huh, this isn't working because people feel like we're not doing enough justice to either VR or AR, so we're going to split it up into just one course and then another course, and then we had another problem, which was that people felt like they were falling behind in the more advanced course, which is why I created the VR Foundations course that was specifically meant to be kind of like an in like an intro
Intermediate
to
or
prepare you for the more advanced thing. So the
sure.
actual course development ends up being, we want you to end with this specific skill set, right? What is like we have to come up with a project that you would do either individually or as a team. But I think we used to do a lot of teaching that was like, this is the project that you're going to do, and we're going to use this project as a method for teaching you these basic skills. So that's what VR Foundations is. But the more advanced course has a lot more emphasis on you have to come up with a project yourself. And in particular, in virtual reality, like one of the places that money really is training simulations. So for the more advanced course, we have like all these step-by-step guides for features that you might want to use in your final project. But what you actually create is a multiplayer training simulation for a digital twin like machine that you invent, right? It in theory could be like an actual robot that you're actually trying to do a digital twin, but like for the sake of making it more interesting, we have them like generate these fantasy machines. I call it the time machine project because the example video that I have is like, here's a time machine that I created. It has a couple of dials and levers and doors that you have to open and objects you have to spawn in, and it's multiplayer, and here's a teacher who's showing me how to do all this stuff. And basically what we do is we ask students to come up with like, what is the machine that you're going to train someone else to do? All right, let's make that machine. Let's talk about how to actually create all of these interactions that you've envisioned for your machine. Like there's a couple of parameters. Like you have to have X amount of at least five different interactions, and one of them has to be sequential, where like one has to happen before the other ones can happen, and things like that. So we give them a couple of parameters, and then we what we because like a huge part of VR development is communicating with a team to define what the project actually is. So we also try and like for the more advanced courses, we try and it like build in working as part of a software development team into the course, right? So that you are working with other people. Unfortunately, because of that kind of requirement of having a bunch of people to work together with, that made it really difficult. Like you said, if we don't have seven people, right, we can't do the course. So we haven't run that course in a bit, unfortunately, because it's sometimes hard to get everybody in the same place at the same time, for those kinds of courses, unfortunately.
Yeah, just th this is great. I was asking you about the course development, like you're training nurse aides and English help. Like you actually, like what are you doing there? And again, like are you laying it all out? Are you just outlining it? Are you working with someone? Are you a one-man shop? That was kind of my question.
When you say training courses, I'm not sure I understand.
Oh,
Like,
I thought you said you were developing curriculum, like using AI to teach people English
oh,
and.
that is so that's based on existing material. So the state of Massachusetts has an online web course, called like PhCast. Basically, they have an online web course that they use. It's like their official curriculum for training people to be home healthcare aides. So
Yeah.
I just straight up took that course, and discovered, and this is like the most recent project I'm working on, the thing that I'm working on the most. We kind of discovered that like this course, it's got a lot of videos, and then the way it checks your knowledge is like multiple choice questions and then self-evaluated like short form responses where you like type your response to something and then self-evaluate. But the thing is, a lot of those situations that they were simulating were like difficult conversations. And if you're like actually having this kind of difficult conversation for real, you're not necessarily going to remember what you typed per se. So what I've been doing is taking this existing kind of state-approved content and taking the scenarios that they themselves have invented and just turn creating an AI character that acts like that, right? So there'll be like the one that I was working on literally before I got on this call was like, so there's this one woman, Marie, who is 81 years old and can't really, she's got osteoarthritis or something, and she can't really lift heavy objects, but she insists on helping you with household chores, despite the fact that she like ha she really easily loses her breath and she has to lean on furniture in order to stay upright, but she insists on continuing to help you with stuff. So this is an example that was given to me basically by the state's own curriculum, and I'm like, okay. And then I have one of the things that Glimpse Group has made for their Foretell Reality platform is an AI authoring tool. So I have the ability to use basically I fill in a bunch of boxes, and I basically give Marie, like we create an AI agent. This is Marie, and she has this personal history and these objectives for the conversation, and she knows these things, or she has these desires. And we basically create an AI conversation that is, you have to explain to Marie, hey, I can't have you lifting heavy boxes, but do you want to help me with this other less physically strenuous task? And you can, say, here's five different opening lines that Marie can tell you. Like either Marie says, hey, I see you're about to vacuum the rug. Can I help move these heavy boxes for you? And you have to say, no, Marie, I will move the heavy boxes, but why don't you sort one of these boxes while I am doing the vacuuming? Or you'll have another opening line where Marie says, oh, you just finished you just finished cooking. Can I help clean? I'll wash the dishes. You can put them away. And you have to be like, Marie, you have difficulty standing, so how about this? How about you dry the dishes and then I will put them away. And kind of stuff, or you have to have these kind of sometimes difficult conversations that require like soft skills that are very difficult to like train until you actually experience trying to have this conversation for the first time. And that's kind of one of the things that we found with this kind of training is like, yeah, a lot of the job of being a home healthcare aide is like doing chores for people. That's like quite like that's the literal mechanics of the job, but a huge portion of it is also talking to old people. Maybe this old person has dementia and can't like and is upset about something, but they have difficulty telling it to you. So you have to practice having a conversation and being patient and letting them speak even when they have difficulty with vocabulary. Or you might have a conversation with someone who doesn't speak English very well and is really mad about the food that you cook for them because it doesn't remind them of the food that they had in Portugal, right? So you have these kind of like typical conversations that you have to, have. And our idea is you can use AI conversations, and especially because it's immersive, it feels like you're actually in the room with them having this conversation, and they adapt to the things that you say and reference what you say. It's a lot more flexible than, say, like a really scripted encounter, right? Where you're like choosing from a
Sure.
pre-selected set of options like they used to do for like Walmart training and things like that. Because the AI agent kind of adapts to what you say and how you say it, it's a lot more realistic. And it's different every time too. Like you can have the AI say, you can start the conversation with a different opening line every time. And the AI agent, if you give it like the proper parameters and behaviors, it'll actually just adapt to what was just said, which is a convenient way of letting people practice these difficult conversations.
All right, got it. How interesting. Okay,
It's
let's
also
take
good
it.
for English language learning, like especially when you're learning a new language, right?
Oh, I'm
Just being able
sure.
to practice a conversation at like 11 p.m. at night when you finally got the kids to bed, you can just have
Yeah.
another person to chat with, and you're
Yeah.
not keeping them up.
Definitely. All right, let's take it back down to 2019. Although, if you feel the story has an earlier logical starting point, we could take it back further than that. But I'm thinking as things are wrapping up Berkeley, you're probably not thinking like VR instructor. I don't know, maybe you are. Put us in your
So,
headspace, yeah, as things are going at Berkeley. And then like we'll take it one step at a time from the start of the story to where you are now, both in terms of what you were doing for work, but also in terms of where you were at mentally in terms of your career.
sure. I went to Berkeley for video game music. That's what I wanted to do. when y at that time, Berkeley had like 271, FS271, which you could take basically almost immediately. And then it had the next one had all these prerequisites, which I was basically only able to start in my sixth semester. Like I did the math. I sat down and did the math. And I was like, oh, like I've taken my one video game music implementation class, and then I'm gonna have to wait another 3 semesters to get to the next one when I do all my prerequisites for contemporary writing and production. So while I was waiting, I wanted to do something related to development, and I found a class with Berkeley. Institute for Creative Entrepreneurship had a class that was held at MIT that was teaching Berkeley, Harvard, and MIT kids how to do VR development specifically to create educational applications. So I did that for a semester, mostly because I realized I would not be able to, like, through Berkeley itself, like the traditional course model, I would have to wait another like year and a half before I could actually continue on my video game music implementation journey, just because of the way things were structured. So I took this other class that I thought would be, somewhat relevant, and it was. It was a lot about Unity development, and I found out at that class that I really enjoy VR development. And while I was there, I was like, well, you can use virtual reality to use the body to control music in a way that you've never been able to do before, right? We have like all these rhythm games, right? Dance Dance Revolution or Guitar Hero, where you have to press buttons in time to the music, and the music is like, your reward basically for performing well. But until now, we haven't really had a game that lets you turn your body into music and actually like remix the song in real time using your dancing. So I started working on that. This was while I was still at Berkeley. So this was like in
Cool.
2018. So this was like a little bit before I graduated. It was like fourth semester or something. I took this class, and then I was like, wait a second, you can do some really cool stuff with this technology if you combine it with interactive music. So before I even left Berkeley, I had started one project called Oversaturated, which when I tested on people at Berkeley, they're like, I have no idea how this works or why. And so that was my first attempt at trying to create an interactive music video in VR. And then I took what I learned from that first sort of failed attempt. I mean, it looked cool, it was awesome. And I basically had a conversation with a friend of mine, and we're like, okay, let's make this as simple as possible. It's just flailing your arms around in different directions, remixes the music in real time. And that was Rave Gazebo, which is a VR application that is flash forward in 2023, published to Steam and the Meta Store. But that was kind of like, that was my it, I called it my dissertation. Like, this is I think that this is possible, and this is how I'm going to do it. And so I graduated Berkeley, and I had to. So like that was basically what started my thing. It was like I wanted to create this interactive music video in VR, which used the controllers in order to, control music in real time using dancing, using the movement of the body to control music in real time. I thought that was a really interesting sort of
Cool.
challenge, and I started working on it. When I actually graduated, I had like a whole bunch of different jobs, like in order to actually get money, that I did wedding sound. I did some sound engineering, and I think my main job was working at a hardware store.
Okay.
I worked at a hardware store for 2 years. This was, starting May 2019, and as you can kind of imagine with this timeline, 8 months into that job, COVID
Right.
hit, and so it was a lot of, oh man, well, here's it's like. Being a retail worker during the pandemic was kind of a special kind of you're a frontline worker kind of deal, but you don't get paid like one kind of thing.
Of course, yeah. By the way, quick check
So
before you pack up. Are
you're
you from,
interfacing with people.
yeah, are
So
you from Massachusetts, by the way, or?
I grew up in DC.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Gotcha. But you stayed in the area.
I stayed in the area after Berkeley. One, because for 1 year. Like I graduated in 2019. Well, she's now my wife. She was my girlfriend at the time. She still had a year left at Berkeley, so she had the
Okay.
pleasure of graduating in 2020.
Oh yeah. I remember that.
But
Okay, cool. So yeah, all right, that sorry to sidetrack, but you were
no
saying
worries.
you're the hard work. Yeah, you're the essential person who's still being paid crap. A very silly
Yeah,
story. I talk about
frontline
that in class.
essential worker interfacing with a bunch of people who don't want to wear masks. Well, like, there's a whole like tower of Russian Jewish grandmas and grandpas right next door that I'm constantly afraid of getting sick. In any case, I did my time, right, as a retail worker in the middle of the freaking pandemic. And I enjoyed it. I had the luxury of an actually competent boss. Which is not to be taken for granted, especially in COVID times. So I actually like I they were the I actually liked the people that I was stuck with, which was great. But I kind of did that and a whole bunch of other side gigs, like including like doing weddings for an Indian band for an Indian wedding kind of company. They did the sound for Indian weddings. I got to kind of help do sound setup for them. I did some DJing. I did some. I even did a little bit of teaching at Interlochen, and I had an opportunity that was given to me to kind of help a summer camp for audio engineering at Interlochen, which was super fun. So it was like the standard kind of like you do any gig that you're given kind of
Sure.
situation. And I also happened to have a decent a decent like day job at the time, which was a hardware store. And I enjoyed that. You use the body, shovel snow, like drive salt around to various clients. Like I enjoyed it, right? But it wasn't, it was definitely a, I need this money while I kind of build up the rest of my career. One of the things that ended up happening for COVID was I got laid off temporarily at the hardware store. Like when the lockdown happened, and they had, it's like, all right, for a month and a half, we're going to see if shutting everything down. And then of course they opened everything up again. But like during that lockdown, I had a friend of mine. Well, because one of the things that I was doing while at the hardware store was I was working on Rave Gazebo on the side, and I was also attending basically every single XR development meetup that ever happened in Boston. It was very much an intentional, I'm going to show up and show up and show up and show up and show up to these events so that people can recognize my face. And it did kind of pay off because in during the lockdown, when everything got kind of shut down, and they couldn't do in-person classes anymore at this company, one of the people who was helping with the curriculum development, named Casey, reached out to me because I was kind of participating in the Boston VR meetup group. I was actually at that time, I was actually kind of co-leading it or a co-organizer. I wasn't the only one, but I was helping kind of with organization stuff. And so he reached out to me. He was like, "Hey, do you want like a gig related to XR development?" And I'm like, "Yes."
Did people know you were looking for work? Like, I know that you're now go meaning like, "Hi, Greg, I need a job." But like, had word gotten around, like people go around the room and you're like,
I
"Hey,
don't
I'm..."
think he didn't seem to think I was like, I remember that conversation. He was like, "Well, do you have time for like some gig work on the side?" It was kind of the how that conversation went. It wasn't really, this was not an offer of a full-time job. I had to
Okay.
build my way up to that for like a couple like a year and a half, where it was like, first I do like some gig work on the side to like help them with some slides, and there was a kind of ever increasing. So like while I worked at the hardware store, that was my day job, and the kind of work with the XR development kind of startup like grew and then grew and then grew and then grew and then grew. And at some point they're like, "We want to hire you full time," because I was such an integral part of the curriculum development process that they had set up, and I was able to teach all the classes
And you said
at
that took
some 2 point.
2 years, so that's like 2022, you become full
Yeah,
time.
like something like that. It was I think it was a little like, I remember it intersected with like, yeah, it was 2022, because I finally got full time, which allowed me to get a house, because before then, nobody would give me a loan to actually buy a house. And
Okay.
so in 2022, I actually got a salary, which enabled me to apply for a loan so I could actually get a house and stop renting. Because that was like,
You and your wife, I imagine, right?
yes, we got married in 21, October 21. And then basically, like the next year, in like, April, March. Well, first they had this fun little thing where they didn't pay me for several months on the
Oh.
kind of contractor thing. I mean, they eventually paid me back for it, but it was like one of those like, really annoying things. And it was because they had just got bought by Glimpse at that time. So there was like a whole bunch of really weird stuff, nonsense happening as they
All
got
right.
acquired.
We're
And
integrating the systems and they bring on
then
Salty.
for several months, like they owed me like $8,000 at one point, which I
Oof.
thankfully had enough of a buffer because I had been given a gift from my family for, to help me get the down payment on a house. But they actually hired me full time at that time, which actually allowed me to get a loan because before that they weren't going to give me one. And I actually got hired full time, 60K, which hasn't changed, though I have asked. But the
I was
idea
gonna
is,
say you're doing so much more these days. They're getting a steal.
exactly. I would say so. So it is like one of those things. But because of this job, I had the security to kind of keep working on my other kind of personal projects, such as Rave Gazebo, which I then ended up releasing in 2023. Right. Like, so I had my day job, which was, first it was all like, hardware store, and then it was teaching classes, and then on the weekends, basically the way I had it set up was, the weekends are my own, and I work on my own projects, and that's when I did Rave Gazebo, because I really wanted Rave Gazebo to work, and it ended up being like a 6-song album. By no means when it was released was it any kind of financial success, but it is a success in that I actually made it, and it is published, and the number of applications I published is greater than one, which is like really important when you're like applying for jobs. It's like, how many apps have you published a single app? And the answer is yes, technically yes, I have published an app. But it was published, and I've gone through that whole process at least once. And the goal is to come, and literally, like, my work on Rave Gazebo got me other gigs too. Like, there was another, I got money from one place because they saw like the trailer for Rave Gazebo online. They're like, oh wow, this is cool art. And so I got a gig because they saw the work I had done on that. So like, Rave Gazebo has been successful in securing me a job, even if Rave Gazebo, the application, was not particularly financially successful per se.
Sure, I
But it
understand.
did the thing that I wanted it to do, which was prove that I am competent at VR development and get me other gigs, which it very much definitely did, including, honestly, I would say, Glimpse. Like, I only got this job at Glimpse because I was active in the VR development community, because I would be constantly going to VR development events, testing out Rave Gazebo visibly in the public, in the group of people in Boston who are interested in XR. I was constantly showing up to that group with an application that I had been developing, showing off my commitment to the XR development field. So there's like infinite value in just showing up to these kinds of events, and like demonstrating that you are available and interested in this kind of work. It is like one of those things where it's like, I feel like I got super lucky just by timing. Hi, Cecilia, I love you.
Yeah.
I got lucky a little bit by timing, just like when I was doing it. Like, that was when you could get away with starting an XR boot camp, and like, you could try it others, and it's not as successful. And to be honest, like, the kind of ecosystem for online software development classes is kind of tough, especially now, because like all of the software development companies are firing like vast swaths of their workforce. So
Right.
it's not, the best time to be teaching people these skills, because there's actually a whole bunch of competent people who already know this stuff who just got fired. So it's not an ideal time, unfortunately. But I
Right.
personally am currently, at least, still employed and working on cool projects. And of course, after I finished Rave Gazebo, I started working on other cool projects on the side. Like, the time that had been set aside, Saturdays and Sundays that had been set aside for Rave Gazebo, I now got to work on other stuff, such as like, a multiplayer looper pedal that won a prize at the MetaQuest Present Platform Hack. Or I recently did a design sprint to make a medical training simulation for the Apple Vision Pro. We have one that trains nurses to change the dressing on a central line catheter. the one that gives medicine directly to your heart. So I worked on, that's like a really recent thing. I'm actually next week going to AWE, which is the Augmented World Expo. It's a conference in Los Angeles, and we're going to be doing like a quick 3-minute lightning round talk about our application. But I am going to be on stage presenting for 3 minutes, which means I'm hopefully going to get some good video of me, at a super cool conference presenting my medical training simulation. That is admittedly the kind of the path that I want my career to take, is I want to be working more on medical XR training simulations, because I think that's like that interests me a lot. So in terms of like where I want my career to go, I want to work more on that. The good news is Glimpse has a couple of those projects already, right? We have MA Skills Lab, we have the birth thing. So those are the projects that I end up working on at Glimpse when we don't have classes to teach. So I get like, just being at Glimpse has been like super useful, just from a perspective of like, well, I get to claim I did work on these projects, because I did. When I wasn't teaching classes, I also participated in these medical related projects. So that's the kind of future kind of trajectory that I hope I get for myself, is working on medical XR training simulations, because I think that has the potential to help people.
That's fantastic. All right. So, next question I have for you. These days, and we'll define these days as 2025. Oh, and
Sure.
let me preface this as there is no right or wrong answer.
Sure.
So, these days, meaning 2025, what, if anything, is your current relationship with music?
With music?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I am still the music stuff that I do tends to be a little bit more focused on how XR can be used to influence music. I would not say I've abandoned music. I did stop playing piano when COVID hit. I was in the middle of a class where it was an electronic music class at Tufts. And when I learned that the lockdown was happening, we were just about to play one of the pieces that I had composed. And I was going to play piano on it. And basically after the lockdown, that kind of was like, all right, I'm not, I did, but I kind of, even before I left Berkeley, knew that piano playing wasn't going to be the way that I really experienced music. But I mean, Rave Gazebo, it's a dance interactive VR album. That's music, right? After that, I worked on a multiplayer looper pedal. That's music. I'm currently working on an application that uses head tracking to send OSC messages over a local area network to control Ableton, which is definitely music. I'm creating a performance tool that uses the Quest headset along with pass-through technology that they've added to the Quest 3 and hand tracking, but more importantly, head tracking, so my hands are still free. So I'm still participating in interactive music 100%. Like that, it is still kind of, it tends to be my side projects, right? It's the stuff that I do on the weekend, but I've like since 20, like since I left Berkeley, I've maintained a strong tradition of using my weekends to work on interactive audio projects, and I'm continuing to do that.
And
It's
as
just
you
that, like, it's not my day job.
right, and I think what I heard you say earlier was that directly they're not paying much at all, but
No.
indirectly they're
Indirect.
leading to great opportunities
Absolutely,
and
right?
skills.
And like, for example, the thing that I just mentioned about like using just head tracking to control my performance, I strongly believe that developing the user interface for completely hands-free interactions is useful not just for musicians, but any job where your hands are busy, such as being a mechanic or a surgeon or anybody who holds tools while they're doing their job, right? You don't necessarily want to be holding controllers, and you don't necessarily want to be, constantly tracking your hands, because your hands are busy with tools. You don't want to accidentally interface with something. So having this kind of head-tracked user interface that I'm using specifically to help me be a performer, I strongly suspect that the user interface like problems that I solve for that will have extreme relevance for other applications, say in the medical XR industry, where let's say you're a surgeon, right? And you want to have all this information displayed in front of you as you perform whatever surgery or whatever. And your hands are busy because you're in the middle of a surgery. But how do you control this kind of interface that gives you information? maybe you just use your head, right? Because you can use your head while your hands are dirty, right? You can just look around, and that's one of the kind of the last kind of interfaces that you've got is you can control where you look. And I think that that's actually, I think the work that I'm doing for my music performance tool has relevance to other parts of XR. I think that musicians, especially in technology, have a tendency to solve problems before everybody else even realizes that they're problems. Because music, like especially now, is a highly technical industry, right? Like really highly technical, even just like understanding wires, understanding MIDI, understanding like routing and controls and DAWs and everything. Like musicians have like this kind of like proximity to technology that a lot of like that has relevance to a lot of other industries, it turns out, right? Where
You know
like,
what, but can I cut you off? Because
go ahead.
you are already answering my next question and
Sure.
you're doing a great job. Let me just officially ask it, so that
Sure.
which is that, yeah, you're doing, sounds like you're doing great on your side stuff and in your main stuff. And my question for you is, people come into virtual reality from different backgrounds, and yeah. What is it that you feel your Berklee experience did well to prepare you for your current career? I was hearing you saying a lot about how musicians think about solving problems before other
Right.
people. And it's
Well,
technical. Yeah, go ahead. Go ahead,
I'll
please.
start with a funny kind of anecdote, which was the first time I got into VR was at that class that was Berkeley, MIT, and Harvard students. And in that class, they split everybody up into teams. And what ended up happening is that all of the Berkeley kids ended up leading those teams because they had the experience leading creative projects of a value of setting parameters, defining a vision, and then evaluating them because they didn't necessarily have the technical like development skills, or they didn't have the subject like the technical development skills that the MIT students had, or the subject matter expertise that some of the Harvard students might have. The Berkeley kids, they were just musicians, dude, but they knew how a project runs, right? They understood like the creative process, which your Harvard MIT students might not necessarily have as intimate familiarity with. So one thing that being a musician is like one like iter constant iteration, right? Checking and then like making a small change and then checking again, then making a small change and then checking again. I mean, especially from a production standpoint, music production standpoint, I do electronic music production. It was a very familiar sort of process. Like, okay, so here I am at my technology program, and it's I hit play and it doesn't exactly work the way I want it to. So I'm going to make a small change and then I'm going to, see if it's better, and then I'm going to make a small change and I'm going to see if it's better. It's a very familiar process for me as an electronic music producer, and it also has incredible like, cohesion with being a VR developer or a software developer, right? Because it's a very similar kind of process. Getting feedback on things, right? Like playing your track for somebody and having them give you feedback and then going back and changing things. That's an incredibly important component of XR development, right? Is going out and getting feedback on your project, and then, taking it with grace. And then going back and using that feedback in order to improve your project. And this is like, the first time you have a track put together, it's terrible almost all the time. And then you have to, iterate on it and then improve the mix and then improve all the other things. So that kind of like perseverance, I just knocked them on my head for emphasis, but you can't see. But like that kind of like, perseverance of like, this isn't good yet, but I'm going to keep working on it and improving it until it is. That definitely Berkeley gave me that. I mean, apart from just like the standard like, yeah, hard work kind of thing, because Berkeley does, you have a lot of projects that you have to work on, and you get some kind of amount of work ethic, I think, from having to complete them all. But I think you do kind of get out of Berkeley what you put into it from terms of effort. And I ended up putting in a lot of effort because not only was I doing Berkeley stuff, but I also started doing VR development stuff on the side, which wasn't actually like when I was working on those interactive music video stuff, like that wasn't part of any class. That was just me like taking some bit of what I had learned at Berkeley about VR development, getting inspired by this idea, and then really running with it and testing it on the people at Berkeley, testing my interactive music applications on musicians to see what they thought, and learning that they thought that it was terrible. That was like oversaturated, for example. I did a live demo at Berkeley in 2019, and they were like, "I don't really understand how this works or why." And like that was an incredibly important part. That was an incredibly important piece of information for me to get right at the time. And that kind of like exposure to like, you know, actually being able to show it to people who were musicians and trying to, you know, defend or show them my cool tool, and then having them be like, this doesn't really do it for me. And then I had to go back to the drawing board and really start thinking about how I would improve it. And then I did, right? That's what Rave Gazebo ended up being. And the people I demo Rave Gazebo to, they get it. Right. It's not exactly a commercial success. I think the large part of it is because it's not multiplayer. So it's not something you can like drag somebody else into to share the musical experience with them. Because it's single player, like you buy it for yourself and you're like, that was cool. But there's no reason for you to tell a friend about it because you're not going to be able to experience it with them. And music is really meant to be shared with other people. So, but I do think that you know, the what Berkeley gave me was, I think the strongest part is just that iterative process of, you know, doing something and then going back and fixing it and then showing it to somebody and getting feedback and then going back and fixing it. And that kind of process was like really important to tech in software development. I think that would be the most important thing that Berkeley gave me, I think.
Sure, that's great. So let's turn that question around now,
Sure.
because Berkeley gives that one degree, the Bachelor's of Music. You went there knowing that you're doing well for yourself, and you're working in a field that's at least, you know, kind of adjacent to what you were studying and related to some stuff you were doing. So great.
Interactive audio. Yeah.
All that said, when you look back at your Berkeley education, is there anything where you say, you know, it would have been really useful to have learned this while I was a Berkeley student, and they could have taught it to me, and they didn't. Is there anything missing or incomplete?
Well, my major was contemporary writing and production, and I do not do a lot of big band writing, in my job. But what I wish I had done, if I could do it again, I mean, even while I was at Berkeley, I described myself as EPD at heart, electronic production and design. There, in particular, Max and Touch Designer are things that I have now encountered needing for several things that I want to do. And I'm now having to start to learn those myself from scratch. And this is not because Berkeley didn't have those classes, right? Berkeley has classes on Max. Berkeley has, I'm pretty sure, has classes on Touch Designer. I don't actually know as much about that one. But those two software tools for like live performance, those exist, right? Those exist, but they're in electronic production and design major.
Okay,
And I was in contemporary writing and
what
production.
I'm hearing is not Berkeley's fault, but you
Not
wish you
Berkeley's
made it.
fault,
Yeah.
but I am in a highly technical field, right? And the kind of interactive stuff that I want to do, like for example, one of the projects I was in recently was we did a hackathon at MIT called the Stage Hack. We had two Xbox Kinects on a little cart, and we had two dancers dancing in front of them, and we used the depth from the Xbox Kinect and sent it over a local area network to Ableton to control music in real time. And I'd compose the music so that there was like one big juicy slider that you could really easily hear when a dancer was up front versus when they went back. We worked on that. That used Touch Designer in order to send that information over the local area network. And then, well, for the Ableton stuff, there was something called Super Collider. But we like I have since learned that another tool that I could have used for that was Max MSP, in order to interpret the OSC messages and turn those into parameters in the, and so I am now in the process of learning a little bit about Max MSP and perhaps at some point learning a little bit about Touch Designer in order to try and create these interactive live experiences. And it's not that I'm like kicking myself or anything, because the path that I was on got me to this point, so something went right. But if I had the chance, I would do electronic production design instead of contemporary writing and production. and really go full in on the technical side of Berkeley's education, because I know I had friends talk to me about classes that they took about the technology that I am now having to learn myself from scratch.
Fair.
So it's kind of more about that per se. I mean, I think yeah, Berkeley had the I think Berkeley had the classes that would be helping me right now. I just didn't take them.
Very fair. Okay, so next question I have, and I've heard this sprinkled through earlier stuff you said, but let's say for the current group of Berkeley students staring out at the big scary world and not quite sure what comes next, what advice do you have?
Show up to events. I mean, the thing is, I kind of knew when I graduated from Berkeley, I knew I wanted to do something in VR. Like, I had committed to that. And I don't know, like, you can use your time at Berkeley to kind of figure out what it is you want to fully commit to. But it really helps to just show up to every event. And so, on top of that, it also becomes really important to represent yourself, to record video of like all stages of your progress, and really try and get a good demo reel going. Like, be constantly, like one. I mean, it's kind of easy to say don't say no to projects, but like to even get in front of projects, you have to show up to a bunch of events and just be known as a person interested in the stuff that you're interested in. And like it the kind of interper you get jobs from friends, right? And you get friends from showing up to a place regularly, right? Especially as adults, right? It's so easy to make friends in school because you're forced to interact with the same people every day, right? You leave college and the only new friends you make are the ones you get when you're attending the same place once a week, right? So like it becomes really, really important to show up just like regularly so that like you won't get friends on the first time you show up, but the fifth time you show up, people will recognize your face and they'll be more comfortable coming up and having a chat with you. And that's how you make friends, right? Like you make friends by just showing up enough times. You don't have to make all the friends on the first time. You kind of have to show up several times and like, kind of just slowly become known as someone interested in the stuff that you're interested in, and find your people. I think that the piece of advice I got at Berkeley that really helped was like my video game music composing teacher. I think it was Duncan Watt actually, who was like, you got to go find your people, right? That's like the most important thing that you can do while at Berkeley is find the people who are interested in the same stuff that you are interested in, right? And then make friends with them, because that's where your jobs come from, right? Is your friends. Your jobs come from friends. You can, especially right now with AI in charge of the hiring process at so many companies, and it's like this soul-sucking kind of like infinite abyss of like applying to a bunch of places and then getting rejected by robots, right? That is not a way to get a job, right? I mean, you can try, right? And I'm sure somebody is being successful at the end of that, probably whoever figured out how to input all of the AI keywords that they wanted. But like the way that you actually get jobs is from your friends. And so the most important part is really finding your friends, like finding the people who are interested in the same thing that you're interested in, so that when they get offered a project that they can't do, they'll be like, well, who do I know that I could recommend for this? And they'll recommend you. Or it'll be like, oh, I just got added to this project and they're asking me if I know a 3D modeler. Well, I do. And I have a friend, 3D modeler, who I'm now going to recommend to them. And they're going to hire this person based on my recommendation. This has happened, right? Like, where like I get hired onto a project and they're like, do you know any other competent people? Right? You want to be one of the competent people that your friends know. And that becomes really important is getting your kind of network of people who are at least related to the kind of stuff that you do. You have to find them, you have to show up, you have to be actual friends with them, more than colleagues. More than just like, acquaintances, you have to actually enjoy spending time with them, because who am I going to hire to work with me on a project long term? It's going to be someone I actually like. It's not going to be the most competent person per se that I know. It's going to be the person I like the most. And so you just got to find friends. And the easiest way to find friends as an adult, especially after like leaving college, you make friends by showing up in the same place multiple times, is how you make friends.
That's great advice. And to zoom in a little bit, I think I mentioned, I feel like you're my 263rd view, could be slightly off. Point is, no one's listening to all these. Anyone who's made it this far is I'll have you there in education training, but of course mentioned that you're, XR educator, and somebody who is made it this far in the interview is maybe thinking about whether it's a virtual reality thing, or maybe to broaden it out, maybe a kind of technical training career. Right. So for somebody who is thinking, they're not doing it yet, but they're thinking along the lines of like, hey, this could be a kind of cool career, right? Like, I don't need to get a doctorate to do it. I'm teaching with people. People are really interested in learning. So, you're not going to have the same behavior stuff that, you get to constantly stay in, abreast with the industry and tweak and refine stuff and get really good at it. There's a lot to recommend this as a career. So for anyone who's thinking about it, but not yet doing it, what specific advice do you have for them?
Have a day job, especially when you're working in like a really new field or new technology. In my head, I'm imagining this person being like, it might not necessarily be VR. It might be AI. It might be some other kind of newfangled technology 5 years from now that we haven't even heard of. But like, if this is something that you're interested in and passionate about, don't expect to have a job in it within the first 2 years. I think I got really lucky that I did actually get a job in it. But the reason I got that job was because I did this work on the side while I did something else for money. So there's kind of like this balance that you have to do is like you really care about this technology and you want to get a job in it to some extent, whether it's teaching. I got really lucky I found a teaching job, but it might be some other kind of gig work that you do in this technology. But that's not going to show up as soon as you exit college. It's just not. I mean, you can try and exit college with a job immediately in this kind of newfangled technology. But like, especially if you're like focused on something new and interesting and shiny, you might have to like wait a little bit and like just put your work out there for a little bit before someone even contacts you about this. So I'm very grateful I got my hardware store gig, and it's not it hardware store had nothing to, but what it did do was let me, live long enough to get Rave Gazebo to a point and to show up to enough events and to do all that kind of like all the other stuff that I did on the side on the weekends was what got me my job. But I was only able to do that stuff because I had a day job, right? Like that, I mean, from my perspective at least, like if I had tried to immediately go out and get a job in VR development, I would not have been successful. Because I didn't have one, I didn't have the demo reel to show people that I was competent at this thing. It's gonna take a couple years at least of you outputting work, regularly before you can be found by someone, depending on what you're doing. I mean, like this is gonna change for different technologies and depending on, whatever the hype cycle stage is at when you exit college, it might be a little different. It might be easier for you to get a job. But I do like I would get a day job. I would get a day job. And then live on whatever, like find a place to live and pay rent and eat food and literally just persist long enough that your extra time, whatever extra free time you get. I got really lucky with the hardware store in that I actually only worked weekdays. That's not really a common thing for retail employees. Ask my wife and she would know. But like being able to like use your whatever extra time you have to work on your passion projects while like literally just survive, like just live. Like if you can persist long enough while working on the thing that you're really passionate about, if you genuinely believe in the thing that you're working on, and this is what you want to do for a career, then you got to be able to live long enough to actually see it through. And for that, you need a day job.
All right, that's keeping it real. I'm sure a lot of people appreciate that. Got one last question for you, Gregory, which is, you have the mic. Is there anything we missed or anything else you'd like to say?
Anything we missed or anything I want to say? I love the work I'm doing. I think it's really cool. I, especially with music, the music stuff that I'm doing, I'm not doing it for money. I'm doing it for myself. The performance tool that I'm creating, I don't expect to make money. Rave Gazebo. I did not expect to make money. I found a way to use the skills I developed while creating these cool projects to make money in a different way, right? And the skills I developed are real, right? The skills I developed making Rave Gazebo are real, but it wasn't Rave Gazebo that got me money, right? And I
Sure.
strongly believe the skills that I've been developing creating this cool performance tool using the headset are real, but I don't think that it's going to be this performance tool that gets me money. So it's, I think it's important to have, if you can at all, like, it's okay for your money to not come from music. Did you know that Ives was an insurance salesman, right? In World War I? Like, he's a famous American composer. He was an insurance salesman in World War I. That's what he did. That's how he made money. But he made some really cool art, with like two bands marching towards each other. That was kind of his deal, right? He did some really weird experimental stuff that we remember fondly and with kindness, right? But what he actually did was he sold insurance, right? But he was still able to find meaning in music because it was for himself. And that's like okay, right? Like, and also I imagine some of what he did in music probably did bleed into the way he actually made money. I don't know exactly how music would probably help with insurance, but honestly, the mental health of working on something cool and like actually being happy with the art that you create, I'm sure has a significant impact on your ability to just live like happily, which influences all parts of your life. I would say that, like, you know, it's okay to work on non-music stuff. In fact, you probably will, right? It's actually kind of hard to make money from music. It's a grind. And I know people who do it, and Godspeed to them. They are doing it. It's incredible that they are even able to do it. But like that is not the only way to make music, right? You can get a day job and work on music on the side and still make some really cool music projects. Rave Gazebo made no money, but oh my God, am I proud that I made it. Like, so proud. I still pull it out. Like, it's a thing that I'm so happy I made. And it didn't make me, I mean, it made me a couple, I sold a couple copies, right? It wasn't zero, right? I made, I think, $100.
The
But like,
per hour is pretty low.
oh, 100%. I spent years on Rave Gazebo, and Rave Gazebo didn't make me money. But the fact that I worked on Rave Gazebo made me tons of money. You know what I mean?
I know exactly what you mean.
Like the skills I made, like from working on those projects, it ends up having application outside of music, and that's where money is. But that also means you should make your money somewhere else, and you should still work on the music projects, because they're awesome and they'll make your soul more peaceful. But there's also every chance that the things that you learn making those, especially if you're in like a fun new technology, right? It's actually highly probable that your experience as a musician will give you a perspective that other people won't have. And that will give you an advantage in the other ways that you make money.
All right, that is wonderful and a really great note to end on. So, Gregory, I really enjoyed this conversation. What an interesting perspective you bring. And thank you so much for making the time.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
All right, best of luck with everything.